That would relieve the Mongol forces to carry out field operations of maneuver, surprise, stealth, and battles of encirclement. So these expertise were gained in these initial campaigns. Those campaigns also resulted in Mongol expeditions into Tibet. The Tibetans essentially paid homage to Mönche, and that is a very important connection because under a sort of a Mongol protection, Tibetan Tantric Buddhism flourishes and eventually becomes the preferred religion of Kublai Khan and all of his successors who will rule as Chinese-styled emperors known as the Yuan Empress. Therefore, once those western areas had been secured in 1259, Mönche and Kublai moved south against the Yangtze River. The Sung army is large. We've got all sorts of estimates how big it is, 600,000 men. They certainly were weak in cavalry. They did not have access to the horses. Whatever cavalry force they could put in the field, it was clearly outclassed by the Mongol army, especially being led by two of the grandsons of Genghis Khan, who brought the majority of the Mongol field forces with them. On the other hand, the whole of the regions on and just north of the Yangtze bristled with fortifications. The river was patrolled by flotillas. There was a navy that secured the coastal zones, particularly the capital city, Linan, which was on the shore, on the sea, the South China Sea, and it was also at the head of the Grand Canal. Immediately, Kublai knew that they would have to gain those fortresses along the Yangtze. That would mean gaining control of the waterways, the canal systems, and in the initial expedition by the two brothers, Mönche and Kublai Khan, the Mongol army got bogged down in a war of sieges along the Yangtze. And on August 11th, 1259, and I referred to that earlier in the lecture with Hulagu, the Khan, Mönche, probably died of cholera while besieging one of the supporting fortresses near the city of Ho Chi Suan, which is one of the strategic cities that had to be taken on the Yangtze. It took several weeks for the news to get out to his brothers. Initially, Kublai thought, well, let's keep pressing operations. He tried to continue fighting in early fall of 1259. And then the news got back to Kublai that dear younger brother back at Karakoram had been palling around with the shamans and the various tribal leaders, had summoned a rump session of the Kurultai, that is the National Assembly, and had himself proclaimed Khan. Well, Kublai was taken aback. He was commanding in China with the bulk of the Mongol nation fighting with them. And his brother, the second brother of the four, who is actually older than Kublai, was fighting, of course, in the West. He was going to zero in and knock out the Mamluks. Both of those brothers were taken aback. This was not apparently agreed upon. And furthermore, the election was very, very much unrepresentative because the vast majority of Mongols were not in the homeland. That meant both Hulagu and Kurultai refused to recognize the election. Now, Berke had to his advantage the fact that he'd been ratified at the traditional meeting place close to the sacred mountains in the Onon Valley. Clearly, all the proper rites had been performed. There was the usual feasting. But the majority of the Mongols didn't accept this. And eventually, Kublai holds his own assembly, his own Kurultai, in Inner Mongolia. And it's the first time the Mongols have ever met an assembly outside the homeland. And they proclaim Kublai the Great Khan. So in early 1260, you have two Great Khans. And for the first time, civil war. Hulagu, from the start, supports Brother Kublai. We don't know whether that's because of personal reasons or because he banked on the fact that Kublai could win. Furthermore, Kublai and Hulagu and Hulagu's sons, and those would be Kublai Khan's nephews, they always seem to be on particularly close terms, as I've mentioned. And the result was the majority of the military force was in the hands of Kublai Khan. Furthermore, he had another advantage. Not only could he invade the homeland, and in 1261, the field army just knocks out the forces of Berke with very little trouble, and Berke retreats west into the central steppes. He tries to contact his relatives, especially the family of Batu, the Jagatayid Khans ruling on the central steppes. He's trying to marshal support among other houses, the family of Genghis Khan. But the real advantage that Kublai Khan had is the wealth and the resources of China. He won the civil war very easily. He cut off food shipments to Mongolia. The development of the Mongolian Empire, the development of Mongolian settlements in the homeland, particularly at the capital, Karakorum, meant that these settlements were now dependent not only on just the luxuries and the tribute of an empire, but also from for basic foodstuffs. The population of Karakorum had swollen to 30 or 50,000 permanent residents. It had to be supplied by tribute, foodstuffs, and other goodies brought in from the Chinese provinces, and Kublai Khan controlled it. And there was very little chance that the tribes would not go over to Kublai Khan. He was helped by a particularly severe winter that drove home the fact that the guy who controls China controls the empire and certainly controls the homeland. And this was a major revelation. It showed essentially a reversal of the position. Yes, Mongolia provided the cavalry that conquered the world empire, but China provides the resources that sustains that homeland. And therefore, Birke Ira, in a very, very tearful reunion, surrenders in 1263. He's retired. He's pensioned off. He dies several years later. There are some rumors of murder, but fundamentally, Kublai Khan had gained the empire. But he had gained it at a price. In order to achieve that position of the great Khan, he had to agree that he would rule the Mongolian homeland, and he had the right to conquer China and incorporate that into a great Eastern Khanate. But there were three other ulus, that is, peoples of the Mongols, and that included the Western reaches, the so-called Golden Horde, as it's known later. And that was ruled by the descendants of Batu. And a grandson of Batu was appointed as Khan. He ruled at Sarai, that is the palace settlement built on the lower Volga. And henceforth, the Khans of the Golden Horde are essentially a bunch of independent rulers. He also had to recognize the right of the Jagatai family, that is the descendants of Jagatai, the second son of Genghis Khan, to control the central steppes. Although it was an open question as who got the Tarim Basin and who got Transoxiana. And that becomes the cockpit of a number of family quarrels and wars, especially in the 14th century. But nonetheless, the central steppes too broke away into an independent ulus. It acknowledged, those Jagatai Khans acknowledged the authority, the prestige of Kublai Khan, but they are essentially on their own. And they, just as the Khans of the Golden Horde, eventually adopted Turkish as their language and embraced Islam. In Iran and Transoxiana, Kublai Khan recognized the son of Hulagu, that is his nephew, Abaka. He became the next Ilkhan. That was a title awarded Hulagu for supporting Genghis Khan in the civil war. It meant the obedient Khan. And the family of Hulagu will continue to rule in Iran, Azerbaijan, Iraq. It will claim control of Transoxiana, and that will change hands repeatedly between these Ilkhans of ruling at Tabriz and their kinsmen ruling on the central steppes. But the Ilkhans, while they had close collaboration with the great Khans of the East, nonetheless, they too were independent. So Kublai Khan, in effect, recognized the partition of the Mongol Empire, a partition that in some ways very much approximated not only cultural lines, but also the geographic lines of the steppes, which I mentioned at the start of this course. Well, in 1268, Kublai Khan reopened the war against the Sung court. He amassed a great army. He had access to the great cavalry forces of Mongolia. That was without a question the core of his army. And he also had the best generals, particularly his finest general was a man named Bayan, who was entrusted with the final mopping up operations after 1273. He also recruited large numbers of Chinese infantry. And above all, he expanded the engineering corps. His nephew, the Elkanah of Persia, or Iran, had sent all sorts of Muslim engineers and technicians. They could build superior engines of war, especially artillery. These would be trebuchets that could fire with deadly accuracy and at great range. Various Sung generals defected to Kublai Khan at the start of the campaign, especially in 1268-1269. They brought not only valuable information, but also explained the fortification systems along the Yangtze. And in addition, they included many subordinate officers who knew the incendiaries, which were ignited by gunpowder. These included primitive grenades or iron bombs that exploded once they were shot by these torsion engines of war, trebuchets. It also included things known as fire lances that are apparently ignited by the gunpowder, which would then burn the Chinese fortified cities, which were largely wooden palisades on top of rammed earth platforms. So Kublai Khan had the best of expertise, and above all, he had great flotillas of paddled river flotillae. These were large numbers of ships that were used to isolate the crucial fortresses along the lower Yangtze, and this was something that had been missing in that earlier campaign with his brother back in 1259, and that was how to take the great Sung fortresses. And these fortresses checked the advance of the Mongol army. The fortresses included several important cities, and they were on the lower Yangtze River, and they protected the Sung capital, Lin'an. And those fortresses were really the scene of major sieges between the start of the war, really, in 1268, and they only finally capitulated in 1273. The fortress of Fengjiang was actually brutally sacked, and that led to the surrender of the other fortresses. And at that point, the Sung court knew that it was over. In addition to the war of sieges and the successes along the Yangtze, Kublai Khan departed from the usual policy of Mongol conquerors. One or two fortresses were singled out because they had defied the Great Khan. But on the whole, the conquest of Sung China was not accompanied by the traditional massacres and atrocities we've seen in the Islamic world or in the on the Western steppes and in Russia and Central Europe. From the start, Kublai Khan intended to win over his these Chinese people as subjects, and already by 1271, he is styling himself as a Chinese-style emperor. So he was going to win this war politically as well as militarily. And by December 1272, when the Persian engineers who had designed these expert machines had battered down the main fortresses, it was clear that the war was over, and Kublai Khan could retire to his capital in the north, a city called Datu, later Beijing, and actually that city is known in Western sources as Xanadu, and he could entrust the final pacification to his leading general, Bai'an. The Sung court just surrendered. There was very little reason to continue fighting. The Grand Dowager Empress led the young boy emperor out. There was a major ceremonial surrender in 1276. Gongzong essentially abdicated. He was pensioned off. He was treated actually quite well by Kublai Khan. There were loyalists who fought for another couple of years, but by 1276, it was over. Kublai Khan had Sung China, with it all of the administrative apparatus to run it. Because in the final stages of the campaign, not only many generals, but large numbers of Confucian scholars, people who represented the Shi, or that Mandarin gentry scholar class, as it's sometimes awkwardly described, they realized it was time to come to terms with Kublai Khan. He did seem to respect, at least to a certain degree, Chinese civilization. And so when the final boy emperor abdicated in 1276, Kublai Khan already was heir to the administration in the traditions of the Sung court. He also fell heir to some of the territorial ambitions. This led him to make two ill-advised invasions of Japan. These were naval invasions. Again, he was following probably in the footsteps of the Tang emperors. And both of these campaigns really went very, very badly. For one, it required the building of large numbers of horse transports, largely done by the Koreans. Large numbers of Chinese were drafted into both invasions. The number of Mongols invaded who were involved were very few. The smaller expedition occurred first in 1274. It landed on the island of Kyushu. It quickly got into trouble because of storms, and much of the fleet was destroyed. Close to half of the expedition did not come back. A larger, probably twice as large, expedition with two great flotillas were sent in 1281. That too failed. The fleet was large, and the army, especially the army, was caught on the beaches by a typhoon. This is the famous kamikaze that the Japanese remember ever after. And the failure of both expeditions in Japan represented, again, the limit of Mongol logistics and military power. Kublai Khan had gone too far. He had reached too far. However, both expeditions were really rather minor in comparison to the conquest of China. And while it was an embarrassment, it certainly didn't endanger the throne or Mongol control of China. Well, what did these great conquests represent? We spent three lectures dealing with the conquest of the West, the conquest of the Islamic world, the conquest of China. All of these were conducted by the grandsons of Genghis Khan. Each one of them can be studied from a strategic and logistical viewpoint that shows that these grandsons were almost on the par of granddad. They certainly all three belong in the hall of great generals or great captains, if you will. The campaigns of Batu and Hulagu were characterized with the kinds of massacre and terrors that was seen in the campaigns of Genghis Khan. Kublai Khan made a significant difference here. He did not engage in that type of terror. He made an attempt to win over the Chinese population. And as a result, by 1271, he was able to rule as a Chinese-style emperor, and he took the name for his dynasty, the Yuan. In fact, the technical name is Da Yuan, which means the Great Yuan. It comes from the Book of Changes, a very important Confucian text. It means that they are the great originators. It was an impeccably Chinese name. And Kublai Khan realized a very, very important lesson, once stated by the Roman historian Livy. It is not only important to know how to win victories, it's also important to know how to use them. And our next two lectures are going to turn to that very question. Whatever the successes, whatever the cost of the Mongol conquest, what did those conquests mean for the greater Eurasian steppes and the sedentary civilizations? Was there really a Mongol peace, or was this more of an illusion?
Lecture 32, Pax Mongolica and Cultural Exchange.
In this lecture, I want to deal with the results and consequences of the great Mongol conquests. We spent considerable time on the conquests of Genghis Khan and then of his three grandsons. Those lectures revealed a Mongol army of extraordinary ability. And the question I posed was, well, what were the results and the benefits as well as the costs of this conquest? Scholars have sometimes spoken of a Pax Mongolica, that is, a Mongol peace that was imposed across the steppes and the related sedentary civilizations that came under Mongol control. On the other hand, there's also a great deal of images, and these images come especially out of popular literature as well as nationalist histories, of a Mongol yoke. This is particularly true of Russian historians, who in many ways would argue that the whole development of Russia was in effect perverted by the long tributary status of the Russian cities to the Khans of the Golden Horde resident at the palace city of Sarai. Both images have foundations in reality, and this lecture is not intended to take a position on one case or the other. It intends to present the facts, present what we do know about Mongol rule in the 13th and early 14th centuries. Well, let's look on the costs. We've mentioned them in passing with the campaigns, various reasons why these actions of terror, these atrocities were committed. It is difficult to estimate how many people were killed or died as a result of the Mongol campaigns, the great Mongol conquests. Numbers run up to fantastic levels, far beyond what we suspect the population of the world was at the time. There are comparisons, sometimes very facile comparisons, that are made to the scientific genocidal extermination of populations by the Nazis or by Stalin with the Great Purges and the collectivization. And again, the Mongols never practiced slaughter quite on that level, and a term such as Holocaust can be essentially belittled by calling every massacre, atrocity, a Holocaust. The Holocaust, in my mind, is really quite exceptional among all atrocities. On the other hand, we do have some potential numbers of what the destruction involved. For instance, it's been estimated that at least 500,000 people, Russians, died as a result of the campaigns of Batu over a course of about 5 years. Many of these were killed in the sacks of Russian cities. Many more probably died of exposure, starvation, and the privations that followed after a Mongol army had swept through, burned all the villages and fields, had turned agriculture to pasture. Again, there's suspicions that there were very high losses of population in the northern Chinese areas, regions that had been under the Jin Emperor, the so-called 16 prefectures, that Genghis Khan's campaigns that climaxed in the conquest of the Jin capitals in northern China in 1215 had a similar destructive level on northern China as Batu's campaigns in Russia. All agree that the destruction wrought against the Islamic cities in Transoxiana by Genghis Khan, later by Hulagu, the destruction of Bagdad, those are colossal numbers of destruction. Hundreds of thousands were slain and died in the aftermath of these destructive invasions. And last but not least, we do have information on the Kingdom of Hungary. That was the campaign in 1241. After defeating the Hungarian army, Batu's soldiers seized the royal treasury and the seal. And the Mongols, through the whole of the summer of 1241, sent out letters that resulted in the surrender of cities and towns, and huge numbers of captives were rounded up, large numbers that are exaggerated in the medieval chronicles. And then in 1241, when Batu had to return to Sarai and get involved in that election of the new great Khan, these captives were slaughtered. And again, we get fantastic numbers of the numbers of Hungarians slain in the retreat by the Mongol army. We have a lot of anecdotal material about the destruction of cities, and perhaps one should suffice, and that is the former capital of Muhammad Shah on near the Aral Sea at the lower Oxus River. That capital, the city of Urgench, was put under siege by Genghis Khan's sons, and the city was essentially leveled. The course of the river was changed in order to undermine the walls, and as a result, the Oxus River actually flowed into the Caspian Sea for the next couple of hundred years. The city lost its water supply. Everything was chopped down, the mulberry trees for silk, the irrigation ditches were deliberately destroyed, and the city was turned into a desert and ruins, and was never rebuilt. Those types of actions can be added up, but it's still difficult to get the full cost of the Mongol conquest, and I don't want to minimize it. We are subject to what our sources tell us. And yes, there's a lot of exaggeration, but there's little doubt that the Mongol conquest exacted a heavy cost on the conquered. On the other hand, scholars could also argue that once the conquests were over, the Mongols imposed peace, certainly on the Eurasian steppes. This is clear with Genghis Khan and his sons. And there are a number of ways of testing what this Pax Mongolica represented. And one way is to look at the cultural exchange and the prosperity. And so what I want to do in the bulk of this lecture is turn to those questions. I mean, what benefits came from the Mongol conquest without minimizing the horrendous costs that were paid by the subject peoples, especially in the initial stages of the conquest? Well, for one thing, the Mongol Khans quickly set up courts. Karakorum in the Mongolian homeland. The Ilkhans, the family of Hulagu, resided at the city of Tabriz. A sarai was built on the Volga by Batu. And then only the family of Jagatai that controlled the Central Asian steppes didn't really have a capital. But the others did build great capitals. And these became markets. They attracted not only trade, but numerous specialists. At all of the Mongol courts, interpreters, translators, administrators were in high demand. Muslims, Christians, Buddhists, all sorts of people appeared at the Mongol court. In addition, these courts were sustained by the deportees, that is, the captives, taken in the Great Conquest. We have a number of anecdotal cases of people being removed far from their homeland to serve the Khans in some capacity. I mentioned that at both Bukhara and Samarkand, apparently craftsmen were spared, and those Muslim craftsmen were sent to the Mongol capital. We have reports of numerous Muslims being settled to restore the devastated lands of northern China, that is the former Jin regions. And these Muslims brought in the cultivation of fruit trees, particularly citrus and the use of lemon. We know of garrisons being recruited among the subject peoples. There's a case of 1,000 Chinese who were recruited and sent very far west. They were posted off on the Iranian frontier. There was another Chinese group that was actually set up in a town. It is on the shores of Lake Urmia today, and that was virtually a Chinatown into the 14th century. That is, the Chinese continued to maintain their own traditions and language. We know of Christians sent to China. These included Alans, who were Christians of the Caucasus, descended from those Iranian nomads back in antiquity. So there's a major movement of population across Eurasia because of the policies of the Khans. Now, some of these movements were forced and certainly not planned. Many of them represented part of the cost of the Mongol conquest. For instance, I mentioned that the Mevlana, that is Jalal ad-Din Rumi, the great mystic, Sufi mystic in Turkey. His family moved from Balkh to Konya because of the Mongols. They were fleeing in terror. Numerous Turks and Muslims fled out of Central Asia and Transoxiana into Delhi and Konya to reinforce the Muslim civilizations there. The ancestors of the Ottoman sultans trace their descent to tribes that fled west before the Mongol hordes. So this movement of population led to all sorts of exchange. And there are a number of individuals that you can look to study at it. One of them is the important scholar Rashid al-Din, and he lived from 1247 to 1318. He dominates the later 13th century. And Rashid al-Din wrote one of the important works that we use to consult about the life of Genghis Khan.